On this week in Enterprise Tech, we know that AppSec and cloud security skills are some of the most demanded out there, but some of the shortages of staff is starting to wear thin on security teams. Clearance will take us through that. Plus, we've heard of Huawei, right? Well, lately they've been popular in the global tech news and infamous in the rumor mills on social media, and it's now time for us to hear directly from them. And you get a chance to right here in Twiat. Today we have Andy Purdy, Chief Security Officer of Huawei Technologies USA. Shouldn't miss it. Twiat on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 404, recorded July 31st, 2020. Security standards not found. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter code ENTERPRISE. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. And by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. Welcome to Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, so glad to see you that you're safe. You've been dodging some hurricanes left and right down there, haven't you?
Yeah, it was almost like there's a force shield right above the Hawaiian Island chain, and Hurricane Douglas just kind of slid right along and, you know, went off in merry way. Some people were saying, oh, it saw COVID and they got out of there because they didn't want to go into a mandatory 14-day quarantine.
Right,
whatever.
Right.
I've been busy packing.
Well, outside hurricanes, you said you're busy packing. Anything else that's keeping your time busy?
Yeah, it's just packing and more packing, trying to stay safe and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah. Sounds good. Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks for being here. We'll start talking about experts. We also have our favorite security enterprise journalist, Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over at Dark Reading. Curtis, how are you, my friend? How's Florida?
Well, we're getting ready to dodge a hurricane down here. We have Isaiah, which may or may not give us some heavy weather sometime this weekend. But regardless of what the weather does, I'm getting ready for Black Hat and DEF CON. You know, both of those come up next week. I've got a bunch of interviews set up. I've chosen the panels I'm going to sit in on and report back out via Twitter and at Dark Reading, and I'm even starting to make my plans for DEF CON next weekend, trying to decide which of the villages I'm going to pop in on. Right now, I'm thinking seriously about the AI village, IoT, and just for me, the ham radio village.
Now, as you gear up the DEF CON, what's the badge this year? Do you have one with you, or have you seen it yet?
I do not have a badge. You know, DEF CON is free and virtual this year, so the badge is optional. But if you get it, the badge is actually a audio cassette that has, as right, DEF CON badges do, let's call it a puzzle on it, as well as some music for the all-important DEF CON soundtrack. The DEF CON badges are always entertaining and show a lot of creativity. This year's no different, even though DEFCON is in, as they're saying, safe mode.
That's right, safe mode. Right. Well, we're looking forward to that coverage for sure. But speaking of gearing up, it's definitely been a busy week in the enterprise, so we should definitely get started. Now, you may have heard AppSec and cloud security skills are some of the most in demand, right? Well, the shortage of staff is starting to actually wear on some security teams. So Curtis will take us through that and how that's doing. Plus, we've all heard of Huawei, and lately they've been popular in the global tech news and infamous in the rumor mills of the social media. And it's not just about releasing new hardware and services. It's time we hear right from them, and right here on TWiET, you're going to get a chance to. Today we have Andy Purdy, Chief Security Officer for Huawei Technology USA, later in the show. But first, it's been a busy week in the enterprise, so let's go ahead and jump in this week's news blips. Now, it wouldn't be an enterprise week without a leak. Now, startups have begun to disclose data breaches after a massive leak of stolen databases was published on a hacker forum this month. This week, Shiny Hunters, a threat actor known for data breaches, began to leak stolen databases of 18 websites for free on a hacker forum. And most of the companies targeted by the attacks appear to be just startups. Now, the list includes chatbooks.com, drizzly.com. I actually have bought in some alcohol from them, dave.com, and many more. I'm going to go change some passwords. The Shiny Hunters group said that they released the databases for free to benefit the community, quote, and as they already made enough money for selling them in private sales. Now, days after contacting these companies about the breaches, data breach disclosures have started to trickle in. Now, the first ones were Drizzly and Scentbird. Now, Drizzly was pretty open about that, their breach, and they detected the breach on July 13th and immediately began a forensic investigation with cybersecurity experts to understand what had happened and what information was obtained. Now, Scentbird followed shortly after. It seems their group targeted startups because their lack of resources and experience in keeping data safe. Now, I would say one thing, go change your password and username if you can on these sites if you haven't done so already. But this definitely sounds like a lesson for all organizations, including startups, that they should take data security serious. Otherwise, it could mean your demise.
Well, citizens are increasingly worried about how companies are using their data. 9 out of every 10 citizens wanting the government to take on a greater role in the protection of their online information, according to a representative survey conducted by professional services firm KPMG. The survey of 1,000 respondents in the United States found that nearly every American, well, that's 97%, considered data privacy to be an important issue, with 87% labeling digital privacy as a human right. Overall, citizens have an increased awareness of the issues and don't like what they see, says Steve Stein, principal of cybersecurity services at KPMG. U.S. citizens are nearly united in their support for more government legislation to protect their rights to data privacy. While 86% of citizens say they must take some responsibility in protecting data, 90% argue that the government should play a role as well. The greatest majority, or 91%, hold that companies should take responsibility. In fact, nearly half respondents consider corporate responsibility for data privacy a key social agenda for businesses, second only to companies' improvement of labor and workforce policies. Consultants recommend that companies make data privacy a priority in 2020 and pay more attention to their customers' concerns about how business uses their data. With the overwhelming support among citizens for more privacy legislation, corporate inaction will likely lead to more legislation if it's not too late to stop it already.
Amazon is saying that police demands for customer data have gone up. Amazon has said the number of demands for user data made by the U.S. federal and local law enforcement have increased more during the first half of 2020 than during the same period a year earlier. The disclosure came in the company's latest transparency report published last Thursday. The figures show that Amazon received 23% more subpoenas and search warrants and 29% increase in court orders compared to the first half of 2019. That includes data collected from its Amazon.com retail storefront, Amazon Echo devices, and its Kindle and Fire tablets. Breaking those figures down, Amazon said it received, quote, 2,416 subpoenas, turning over all or partial user data in 70% of the cases, 543 search warrants, turning over all or partial user data in 79% of cases, 146 court orders turning over all or partial user data in 74% of cases. The number of requests to the company's cloud services, Amazon Web Services, also went up compared to a year earlier. Well, my comment is this: is that while this is Big Brother and they might be listening, it seems law enforcement is taking advantage of some new tools. My suggestion is to make sure the mute button on top of your Echo is on if you want privacy. And maybe as a suggestion to Amazon, perhaps you might want to consider a more prominent mute button on future models to go with the camera shutters you started adding on some of your emerging devices.
Now, for years, free speech and press freedoms have been under attack in the country, Turkey. Now, the country has the distinction of being the world's largest jailer of journalists and has been in the recent years been cracking down on online speech. Now, in a new law passed by the Turkish parliament on July 29th introduces sweeping new powers and takes the country another giant step forward towards further censoring speech online. Now, the law was ushered through parliament pretty quickly and without allowing for opposition or stakeholder inputs, and aims for complete control over social media platforms and the speech they host. Now, the bill was introduced after a series of allegedly insulting tweets aimed at their president's daughter and son-in-law, and aims to eradicate hate speech and harassment online. Now, the law would mandate social media platforms with more than a million daily users to appoint a local representative in Turkey, which activists are concerned will enable the government to conduct even more censorship and surveillance. Now, failure to do so could result in advertisement bans, steep penalty fees, and most troublingly, bandwidth restrictions. Now, shockingly, the legislation introduced new powers for courts to order internet providers to throttle social media platforms' bandwidth up to 90%. Practically blocking access to those sites. Now, local representatives would be tasked with responding to government requests to block or take down content. Now, the law foresees that companies would be required to remove content that allegedly violates, quote, personal rights and the privacy of personal life within 48 hours of receiving a court order or face heavy fines and penalties. Now, it also includes provisions that would require social media platforms to store users' data locally, prompting fears that providers would be obliged to transmit those data to the authorities, which experts expect to aggravate the already rampant self-censorship of Turkish social media users. Now, Turkish officials reference Germany's Network Enforcement Act, or NetzDG for short, which claims to tackle, quote, hate speech and illegal content on social networks, and was passed in late 2017. Now, it sounds like countries like these may be forcing free speech businesses out of the countries in the near future until revolution occurs.
A Florida teen has been arrested for orchestrating last week's Twitter hack. U.S. authorities have announced that they arrested the main suspect behind this month's major Twitter hack and charged two others as accomplices. According to Florida news outlet WFLA-TV, which first reported on the arrest, Graham Ivan Clark, a 17-year-old teen from Tampa, Florida, was arrested early this morning in Tampa following a nationwide collaboration between the FBI, IRS, DOJ, and Secret Service. According to a press release from the DA's office, the teen now faces 30 felony charges. Hours after the press conference, the U.S. Department of Justice announced additional charges against two other suspects, Mason Shepard, a.k.a. Chaywan, 19, of Bognor Regis in the U.K., and Nima Fazeli, a.k.a. Rolex, 22, of Orlando, Florida, who are believed to have helped Clark in the hack. Twitter said hackers used phone-based social engineering to gain access to Twitter employee accounts, while a New York Times report has said that hackers breached employee Slack accounts and found credentials for the Twitter backend pinned inside a Slack channel. Hackers interacted with 130 accounts, according to Twitter, and for 45 of those accounts, they initiated a password reset, logged into the account, and sent tweets to promote their cryptocurrency scam. Twitter has said that it has since restricted the number of employees who can access those internal tools.
More hacker news. In this case, they broke into some, quote, real news sites to plant fake stories. Over the past few years, online disinformation has taken evolutionary steps forward, with the Internet Research Agency pumping out artificial outrage on social media and hackers leaking documents, both real and fabricated, to suit their narrative. More recently, Eastern Europe has faced a broad campaign that takes fake news ops to yet another level, hacking legitimate news sites to plant fake stories, then hurriedly amplifying them on social media before they're taken down. On Wednesday, security firm FireEye released a report on disinformation focus group it's calling Ghostwriter. The propagandists have recreated and disseminated disinformation since at least March 2017, with a focus on undermining NATO and the U.S. troops in Poland and the Baltics. They've posted fake content on everything from social media to pro-Russian news websites. In some cases, FireEye says Ghostwriter has deployed a bolder tactic, hacking the content management systems of news websites to post their own stories. They then disseminate their literal fake news with spoofed emails, social media, and even op-eds the propagandists write on other sites that accept user-generated content. Wow, this just brings new light to the term fake news. Now, I don't know, is it time to start putting hashing codes for posted stories? Maybe.
Now, most online communication companies are seeing stress with more remote people during this pandemic. Now, Zoom is one of those companies that has been hit pretty hard with this set of issues this year. Now, Zoom bombing being one of those issues. However, Zoom has another problem. A simple vulnerability found in the web client of video conferencing platform Zoom could have allowed hackers to listen in on any private meeting of their choosing. That's right, private meeting. Now, identified by Tom Anthony, VP product at SEO firm SearchPilot, the Zoom vulnerability stemmed from the absence of rate limiting on private meeting login attempts. Now, Zoom meetings used to be protected by a six-digit numeric password, making it for a maximum of 1 million different permutations. Now, this might sound like a considerable number, but using a simple Python program, a hacker can easily trial all possible passwords and brute force their way into any meeting in just minutes. Now, meetings are set to take place at regular intervals, where are particularly vulnerable to attacks since the password remains the same for each batch scheduled meetings. Now, since March, researchers have uncovered a lot of vulnerabilities in the service, from the opportunity for credential theft to app hijacking and malicious code injection and more, forcing the companies to suspend product development for a period to focus on eliminating security bugs. Now, after verifying the brute force exploit using a crude Python program running on AWS machine, Anthony disclosed the vulnerability on April 1st, which led to the suspension of the web client on April 2nd, an outage that lasted for about a week. Now, during that time, Zoom implemented a policy that required web client users to log into an account before joining the meeting. Now, the company also made default passwords longer and included non-numeric characters, drastically increasing the number of possible password permutations. About time. Now, over time, Zoom will eventually evolve their service into one that might be more secure, but it also might seem that it might be harder to use as well. We'll have to see. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week at Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you're probably already storing data. It could be on-prem or already in the cloud. Well, if you're considering cloud storage, think about this. Wasabi is 80% cheaper than Amazon S3 and significantly cheaper than on-premise storage. Now, typically, you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the annual cost of the maintenance fees on the same amount of on-prem storage. Now, Wasabi's disruptive price performance model makes buying cloud storage a natural addition. In fact, if you are a managed service provider, Wasabi is a perfect solution for you to sell because you can earn more while charging less. Now, there are two ways to pay. You can pay as you go, or you can pay one time with a reserved capacity storage. Wasabi's reserved capacity storage makes buying cloud storage a natural addition to your on-prem storage. Now, if you're looking and thinking about buying more hardware storage compared to the price against 5 years of reserved cloud storage, you should definitely take a look at that. You can purchase cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments and achieve greater discounts for term and capacity. Now, with Wasabi, security is often even greater than on-prem service storage. Provides 11 nines of durability, 11 nines. That's unheard of nowadays. This means on average, you lose one file every 649,000 years. That means you're not going to lose one. Now, hosted in premier tier 4 data center facilities that are highly secure and fully redundant, Wasabi is secure by default. And all data stored in the Wasabi cloud is also encrypted at rest, even if the requesting party doesn't specify encryption. Wasabi follows industry-best security models and design practices. They have access control mechanisms such as bucket policies and ACL lists can actually be used to selectively grant permissions. Now, your data will be immutable, so it prevents data from being erased or altered, and you'll be protected from hackers, malware, and yourself. That's right, yourself. Now, Wasabi has active integrity checks where all objects stored are checked for integrity every 90 days. Plus, if you're worried about compliance, they have HIPAA, FINRA, and CGIS compliant as well. Now, Wasabi is not just highly secure, disruptive technology that's turning the industry on its ear. Its storage is 80% cheaper and up to 6 times faster than the leading experts out there. Now, if you are ready to reduce your COGS and get all the things you need to be performant, compliant, and secure, go try Wasabi right now. Go build something great. Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure you use the code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support of this week. Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites, and I'm going to throw it over to Curtis because AppSec and cloud security skills are on high demand, but security groups and teams are starting to wear thin on them because they need these people and they can't get them fast enough. Curtis, what's going on here?
Well, you're absolutely right. A lot of articles have been written, and we've talked about the fact that there's a huge mismatch between the number of trained security professionals and the number of positions for them. If you haven't been keeping up, there are far more positions than there are professionals. A couple of new studies say that an ill-defined career path is hampering the growth for those IT security pros and contributing to the shortage that we have. A new report by Enterprise Strategy Group and the Information Systems Security Association shows people with IT security skills continue to be a blazing hot commodity, but a continuous lack of training, career development, and long-term planning often results in many of them largely going through their careers overworked, overstressed, and with very little strategic direction. Organizations should demonstrate care and willingness to invest in employees and staff, says Candy Alexander, president of ISSA International. She says, don't treat them as a resource that's easily replaced, because they're not. Take time to understand their roles and positions, and don't be afraid to ask questions and keep the dialogue open. Now, some 73% of the 327 total cybersecurity professionals and ISA members interviewed for the report professed to being contacted by recruiters for other jobs at least once a month. Nearly a quarter said they received such solicitations multiple times a week. And the data shows that the market for cybersecurity talent continues to be a seller's market, according to the report. Some 70% of survey respondents said their organizations had been impacted by a skills shortage, and 45% described that situation as having worsened over the last few years. Now, where are the most significant skill shortages? Application security and cloud security, 33 and 31% shortage respectively. Other areas with high demand include security analysts and investigations and security engineers. Now, because of an increased workload, existing staff has very little opportunity to utilize technology to their full potential and have little time to work with the business units. Instead, many of them spend a disproportionate amount of time on incident response and basically putting out fires. Now, disturbingly, the pace and pressure of the job are pushing at least some to depression, alcoholism, and drug addiction, according to the report, with nearly a third say they or someone they know has experienced significant personal issues because of job-related stress. Now, in order to improve their skills, many of these professionals are using the bluntest of blunt force instruments. They're changing jobs. Some 43% said that having a mentor, a standardized career map, and technical training were critical to move to the next level. And 7 out of 10 say that the most effective method to increase their knowledge, skills, and abilities is via specifically security training courses. Now, from an industry perspective, it's critical for the profession to work together to define a globally accepted professional career map. And I'll say that I wrote an article this week that said that part of that map might well be coming up with succinct, consistent job titles. In talking to career professionals, I'm talking about corporate recruiters, found that there really is no standard meaning for terms like security analyst, analyst one, analyst two, security architect, security engineer. They're just all over the map. And so people have very little way of knowing when they see a job being offered what it means. And people who are hiring have very little way of knowing whether a candidate who has a particular position on their resume has the skills. So I'm going to go to my co-hosts. And Lou, I want to start with you. How murky do you see this career path in, well, IT professionals in general and cybersecurity specifically? Do you think this is an area where some sort of common vocabulary might help?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good point. I think that there's so much to take care of here, and it's an ever-changing market. It's really hard to kind of focus on things. But obviously, there's focusing on particular fundamentals, like, for instance, infrastructure, networking, and other topics that you can focus on when it comes to skill sets. But when it comes to staying on the forefront of security issues or, hacker ways of doing hacking and network security, it's really tough. And so I think you're right. I think there needs to be a common language, a common set of ways of talking about these things. And another way to actually stay up on these things, too, like finding a process or a set of principles to stay on focus on those things. So, yeah, I definitely think that a common language would help. But again, because the market's changing so quickly, you never know. You might actually end up that vocabulary actually having to change as well.
Well, that's certainly true. I want to turn to Brian. I know, Brian, that you have you have been an advisor and a mentor to lots and lots of young people as they were beginning their careers, and you've talked to many people as they progress through their careers. What kind of advice have you given regarding titles, or do you find that titles really don't matter that much regardless of what we say?
Actually, my first piece of advice for anyone that thinks they want to get into security is shut the heck up on social media. I've actually had a couple of students that have managed to spectacularly trash their chances at getting a security clearance because they wouldn't shut up on social media. So that's a big piece of advice. The other sad part is that, at least in my experience, I used to be the information system security manager for a fairly large university. And unfortunately, that position got taken away. I didn't leave. It got taken away because the person put in my place was more politically correct than I was. I had the cardinal sin of calling a spade a spade. So that kind of trashed my ISSM career pretty quick. But anyway, there's a lot of problems with a lot of the information system security positions that they're badly described. There's no good common language. I think there needs to be some good templates for people to use for describing the positions. Maybe the ISSA needs to step in a little stronger, especially with management companies, management organizations, because management in general typically don't understand what a cybersecurity specialist really does. It's kind of a black box to a lot of managers. And, it's a new thing that needs to change over time, and I think it needs to be changed cooperatively. So this sounds actually like a really good column for dark reading, if you ask me.
Funny thing that, the career path is going to continue to be jumbled, but professionals are going to continue to be in great demand, which is great because it gives us lots to talk about here on TWiET for a long time into the future. Now, it's not so long in the future, but we've got plenty more to talk about on this episode of TWiET. And to get us headed in that direction, Lou, we're going to turn it back over to you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on Twilight Ride. But before we get to that, we have a really great sponsor we have to thank for this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is a provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Now, think about it. Suddenly, you have dozens, hundreds, or maybe even thousands of employees working remotely, each one of them getting tons of emails every day, making them vulnerable. Now, 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeovers, conversation hijacking. Multiply that by how many employees you have times how many emails. One click, the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and your company reputation. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have observed a recent spike of 667%. In this type of attack since February. Now get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes all-in-one security, email security, backup, archiving, AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise, and automated incident response that gives you the option to quickly and efficiently address attacks as they come. Now, security awareness training helps educate your employees and your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against these attacks. Now, we've covered this a couple times on Twilight. Now, in the current climate, the bad guys are targeting people using social engineering and techniques. We even heard it here about the Twitter issue. Now, they impersonate organizations like, for instance, the UN World Health Organization and the U.S. Center for Disease Control, CDC. Now, to trick users, they want you to open this malicious email out. They want you to click on that site, and they want to take you to some site where then they can take over your device. Now, it's time to take back control of your security. Ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. That's barracuda.com/enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, this is my favorite part of the show. We get to bring the guests to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. Today we have Andy Purdy. He's the Chief Security Officer for Huawei Technology USA. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories and kind of their journey through tech over time. Can you maybe take us through your journey and how you ended up at Huawei US?
Well, I was a lawyer for a long time and got involved when I was the acting general counsel of the U.S. Sentencing Commission, where compliance was an important part of it. Got involved in understanding and learning about new technology offenses, which was back in the early 2000, and organized a conference about new technology offenses. And some of the folks who I got to come speak, such as the late Howard Schmidt, really got me excited about moving into cybersecurity. And I joined, thanks to Howard Schmidt, I joined the White House staff in 2002 to work on the national strategy to secure cyberspace. So I went over to DHS, did some work there, and then worked with a number of startups, and then worked for Computer Sciences Corporation. And then I had an opportunity to join Huawei. Actually, it's 8 years ago, an opportunity to promote a safer cyberspace, which is what I've been doing. And it's turned into a fairly controversial situation, but it's been very interesting, and I like to contribute to the dialogue.
Right. Well, first, unless you've been living under a tech rock, people probably have heard of Huawei. But for people who – there's a select few out there who haven't heard, can you maybe take us through what Huawei has to offer and some of the services that it has?
Well, the major business areas are in the carrier network space, the enterprise space, consumer devices. And now we're moving heavily into artificial intelligence and cloud as their own business units. We recently passed Samsung as the number one mobile device provider, and we're very active in 5G, a particular radio access network part. And so we're one of the leading providers in the radio access network technology, and right now we're one of the leading leaders in getting new patents and 5G-related patents.
Right. Now, you mentioned enterprise and IT. Now, what kind of IT-related products are you – do you have anything focused there as well from a Huawei perspective?
You're talking about like infrastructure?
Yeah, infrastructure, networking, services, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, we in some parts of the world, we do managed services. but we sell, you know, wireless networks, we sell routers, we sell base stations, smart city solutions, servers, and then the capabilities that help promote the infrastructure and the platforms that can support the really robust data analytics and artificial and augmented intelligence.
Makes sense. Now, you did mention, obviously, that Huawei surpassed Samsung to be the world's number one smartphone company for the first time. Can you maybe talk a little bit about where you saw the growth and what was maybe driving that growth?
Well, I mean, you just saw, I guess it was yesterday, last night, or this morning, the recent Apple earnings report from second quarter and the tremendous boom in smartphone sales that Apple had. And so I think there's a general increasing recognition of the importance of technology in general, the increasing criticality of mobile devices and wireless and broadband connectivity. Has been a huge driver. Our business in the last 6 months has been a much higher percentage of it has been China-based because of the restrictions of the U.S. government on our ability to partner with Google and the collaborations as necessary as part of the Android platform. It's basically an open source platform, but we can't collaborate with Google anymore, so we can't have the Google apps on the phone. So that's impacted our ability to sell devices in non-China parts of the world. And so we've had a much greater percentage of our growth taking place in China. I prefer it to be much more of a globally spread out sales than such a focus on China.
Right. Now, we'll definitely get into the U.S.-China relations and how that's affecting Huawei in a little bit. But I did want to talk a little bit about the 5G growth. So obviously, you've seen a lot of 5G push since your devices are the most prevalent in the world today. And there's lots of need for 5G infrastructure. Where are you seeing the most investments needed for 5G? Is it and where what parts of the world is it needed?
Well, I mean, everybody is trying to be, you know, really active in it. Certainly, China is one of the leaders. South Korea, the UK was going to be one of the leaders until the recent decision. Europe's really trying to ramp up. However, you know, the impacts of the pandemic have really slowed down the processes and the focus of some governments on some of the things that are necessary, such as the spectrum allocation, the co-location of base stations, the various licensing requirements. So it's really driven in individual countries that have the capability and interest where the companies and governments can see the business case. And those have really driven the progress. But you see the activity really widely distributed around the world. So we know that 5G and this first incarnation, this first set of business scenarios is going to be very, very robust, rolled out in this year and next.
Right. Now, obviously, Huawei's got a global presence. Can you maybe talk a little bit about the differences between the mainland China Huawei and the Huawei Americas business?
Well, I mean, I'm not that familiar with what we do in China, frankly. I have been to 26 countries since I joined Huawei. So even though my focus is the U.S., I have had a chance to meet with leaders in all parts of the world, government and private leaders. In fact, my last trip, and it's great to be home for a change, the reasons are not too great, but came back from Australia on March 13th from a 4-city, 3-day tour in Australia. But Asia, Europe, the Gulf, seeing what countries see, we are really driven by the requirements of our customers within the context of the regulatory statutory framework, customer requirements, and our own business requirements. You were mentioning privacy earlier. So, for example, Europe, of course, the GDPR privacy regulations provide a consistency that is lacking in the United States, where we don't have national privacy policy. And that's something that a lot of people think would be a good idea, and I certainly do as well.
Yeah, I think this is an important topic. I think obviously we've been hearing a lot around the world around some of the issues that companies are having with Huawei and how they're pushing back on some of the 5G infrastructure improvements that are happening from Huawei. So I think most recently it was the UK and Germany. Now, how is this affecting the focus for privacy and security at Huawei as these kind of topics come up, especially the pushback from these companies and these countries?
Well, I'm not sure that Germany has made a turn against Huawei. And the UK decision was not based on what President Trump and Secretary Pompeo said, where they said it was based on the UK coming to believe that Huawei is an arm of the Chinese Communist Party, which is not what the UK government concluded by any means, and it's not something that Australia has concluded either. Our focus on trying to be more effective and more transparent about what we're doing in terms of cybersecurity and user privacy protection has been, you know, what I've been experiencing and being a part of since I joined Huawei just over 8 years ago. And part of it is the effort to build greater standards, internationally recognized standards that can provide a higher level of assurance, but independent testing as well. So that way you can make sure that the telecom and mobile operators, for example, are doing what they need to do. You need independent testing, given the sophistication of the threat. And of course, it's a shared responsibility, as the folks at Orange and elsewhere have said. You've got the telecom and mobile operators on the one hand, and you've got the equipment vendors on the other and other third-party suppliers. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding as recently as this week with one of the representatives of the State Department in a conference just stating something that is just patently false. And he has a tendency to do this over and over again, which is really mind-numbing. He ignores the role of the telecom and mobile operators in controlling and managing cybersecurity and controlling whether, how, and when a telecom supplier such as us might access customer network and customer data, and the processes that are done to make sure it's done under the strict oversight and strict technology and policy controls to help protect security and to help protect privacy. So there really isn't enough emphasis yet. And now I think the U.S. government is now going to start getting involved in 5G standards, which have led to security enhancements for this first phase of 5G, which is really on the increased speed in mobility. And that is great news because then the U.S. government can be part of the whole the threat matrix as we move into the other parts of 5G for the next 3 to 5 years as the technology enabling features of 5G, which are going to bring the huge benefits to all of us, including the ability to use the big data analytics, robotics, machine learning, and AI to help drive and create digital industries and services. But given the sophistication of the threat, it is critically important that one's thinking about the benefits of 5G or the benefits of technology. Competition is critically important. And you need to make sure there's an objective and transparent basis for knowing which products and services are worthy of trust.
Makes sense. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here behind the scenes. Cheebert, I want to throw it over to you first.
Actually, my question is coming from actually several places, some of the folks that I work with, some of the folks in the chat room, and one of the other hosts. And they're asking me to ask, how would you respond to the, claims, rumors that some of the code that Huawei has been using in especially network equipment has, shall we say, been squishy on their right to be used? And the second half of the question really is, how do you feel about someday maybe the industry moves towards an independent third party to validate network security code and so forth beyond just having to trust us?
Oh, absolutely. Let me start with the final point. In fact, we have a transparency center in Brussels that not only customers can go in and evaluate our product, governments, independent experts can do it. The only reason we've had the relationship we've had in the UK for the last 10 or 11 years is because we have an independent cybersecurity evaluation center overseen by the UK government. We have a center in Bonn, Germany that the BSI is working on in terms of independent verification of the products. And when you look at telecom equipment, as you may know, in addition to the 5G standards, there are standards focused on telecom equipment, us and our competitors. And that's the NESAS, Network Equipment Security Assurance Scheme. And that sets out the standards for the telecom equipment and provisions for independent testing of the products, modeled after the common criteria approach where you have recognized laboratories. So we are absolutely all in with the idea of independent testing of products. And in fact, I'd go one step further. I'd love to see the community, you know, you folks and folks that you know, call on, and same ought to happen with telecom and mobile operators, but call on Huawei and our competitors. Let's have a transparency and assurance initiative. Let's drill down and get experts to come in to the facilities of us and our competitors to analyze what we are doing and how we're doing it to make sure that our people are doing the right thing, to make sure that the managers know, to make sure that separation of duties is being followed, to make sure that the executives are getting fair reports of what's happening. And somebody needs to call on us and our competitors, because we've been trying to do this stuff on our own, to come up with minimum industry best practices for assurance and transparency. And bring in experts into the facilities, because there needs to be better R&D as to what is effective and better R&D in terms of what can provide transparency. So maybe there needs to be some kind of third parties that would get placed in the manufacturing facilities of us and our competitors to help manage. Similarly, and you're probably aware of this, that DHS a year or so ago talked about the need to supplement the continuous diagnostic and monitoring program, a very important program that monitors traffic across the federal agencies. It's been offered for critical infrastructure, but they have to pay for it. So DHS wants more information about how do you monitor network traffic? How do you look at anomalous activity? And so NIST put out a call for information, and you know, we fully support this. There needs to be experts need to say, what can we and our competitors do to provide greater assurance and more transparency? Because the sophistication of the malicious actors, where you have at least five in the world, and the national security correspondent in the New York Times told me it's six, who can virtually implant hidden functionality in hardware and software that could be later triggered remotely at a time and a manner in the attacker's choosing. So that's why we need to have these processes relative to everybody, because at least these five nation states, which of course includes China and the US, can hack into everything. So if we want to be safe, we can't trust anybody. And the US government in the last week or so is talking about distrust and verify. I'm all in for that. We've got to do that.
And actually, this is actually one of the big soapboxes Kurt and I have been on, that we're not seeing organizations, the end users, the consumers, doing their own testing. It used to be a big deal. Kurt and I both used to run very large testing labs. I used to run the biggest one for InfraWorld. And my biggest soapbox is customers don't believe the glossies. You need to start doing your own testing. Maybe that's something we need to go and start bringing back. We need to have more of the end users doing their own testing. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure it's necessarily very likely that end user consumers can do that. But for example, in our space, when we're selling to the telecom and mobile operators, they're making sure there's testing of our stuff, testing of our updates, for example, before it goes in. Look at something like mobile devices in the United States. A couple years ago, the U.S. government put pressure on AT&T and Verizon, and they'd invested millions of dollars because they wanted to be able to offer our phones. And they basically blocked them for national security reasons. You tell me what testing is done or overseen by the U.S. government relative to mobile devices, mobile device security in the United States. I don't know of any.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you. My personal soapbox. Anyway, you know what? I think it's time for us to go and pay some bills. Back to Lou.
That is. Thank you very much. So before we come back, we have to think of another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Security Scorecard. Now, with all organizations I work with, I can definitely tell you that they're always looking for ways to audit themselves and assess cyber risk. We've been talking about it, especially with the way the current climate is and ever-changing security landscape. Now, Security Scorecard is the global leader in cybersecurity ratings and the only service with 1.5 million companies continuously rated. Now, their mission is to empower every organization with collaborative security intelligence, because you are only as secure as those you work with. Now, we always say that here on TWI, you're only as secure as your weakest link, and that's definitely your users. Now, Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. They have patented rating technology used over by 1,000 organizations for multiple use cases. You can evaluate your organization's cybersecurity risk using data-driven, objective, and continuously evolving metrics that provide visibility into your organization's information security control weaknesses with their security scorecard rating system. Now, you can instantly view the cybersecurity posture of any third-party vendor, partner, or supplier to help you evaluate risk in your ecosystem. It can also allow them to find and fix cybersecurity risks and vulnerabilities across their externally facing digital footprint with their third-party risk management service. Now, they're also used for board and executive-level reporting and the insurance space for cyber insurance underwriting. That's right. A security scorecard is always working for you behind the scenes. They have non-intrusively collected data, publicly available feeds across the internet for an outside-in perspective. Now, the data is used to calculate scores across 10 key risk factor groups, such as patch and cadence, application security, DNS health, network security, and endpoint security. An A to F grading scale helps companies easily understand and continuously monitor the cybersecurity posture of any organization. Now, companies with C, D, or F are actually 5 times more likely to be breached. That's pretty high. Security Scorecard also has their Atlas platform. It's the leading cybersecurity questionnaire and validation solution. It cuts through the questionnaire noise so you can find out your score to make your business cyber secure. Now, Atlas's centralized platform leverages machine learning to automate the cybersecurity questionnaire exchange process for senders and receivers, make it 2 times faster, more accurate, and secure. Now, Atlas is the only platform in the market that instantly maps cybersecurity rating data to individual responses, providing a true 360-degree view of risk. Now, cut the questionnaire cycle in half, save hours with 20-plus industry-standard questionnaires or their custom questionnaire wizard. Collaborate easily and securely with your team and third parties. Security Scorecard believes that every business has a right to its own cybersecurity rating. They were awarded Best Product Security Ratings by 2020 SE Magazine Awards. And now I hope you've been listening, because Security Scorecard is something all organizations should be using to assess their risk. The combined power of Security Scorecard ratings and Atlas gives organizations a 360-degree view of cybersecurity for any company in the world. Sign up for your free account by visiting securityscorecard.com/twit. Check the score of your business and up to 5 others. To learn more, sign up for your free account. Visit securityscorecard.com/twit. And we thank Security Scorecard for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Andy Purdy. He's the Chief Security Officer over at Huawei Technologies USA. Andy, thank you so much for being here. I do want to bring in my my other co-host, Kurt, because he's been chomping at the bit. He has some questions for you. Kurt?
I appreciate it. Yeah, I do have some questions. And one of them is getting back to this notion of some standards in security. We know that the number of companies that can provide carrier-grade infrastructure, it's a small universe. And there are engineering associations and committees that handle pretty much every facet of those bits of equipment. Do the nations themselves make it more difficult for the infrastructure providers to come together and say, we can set up standards for providing secure private communications wherever it happens to be in the world?
Well, I think right now there's tremendous collaboration. I mean, the 5G effort with 3GPP and GSMA for the internet infrastructure is very much across the board. And now the telecom equipment standards, the NESAS, and you see it strengthened by what the process you may be aware of going on in the EU, where a lot of input is going to be gathered in August and early September based on the whole work they did with the 5G threat assessment. So there's going to be an awful lot, and maybe it'll be similar to a GDPR privacy type thing, but I think there could be hopefully a fairly consistent approach of standards and requirements in the EU that could have perhaps be a model for what we're doing in the U.S., although they have a tendency sometimes to simply say, well, here's a toolbox, here's a bunch of stuff you can do. And I don't know if that's quite as good as having some standards that provide minimum.
Well, talking about the international, you mentioned especially 5G being implemented around the world in various ways and on various schedules. When you get to some of the developing nations, are you finding that they are more willing to lean on some of the work being done by, say, the EU for the standards that they're willing to accept? Does that make it easier from a security perspective if some of the developing nations can lean on the work of some of the more developed nations?
I think there's a tendency for individual countries wanting to do it their own way. And before I get to your question about the less developed, certainly in the developing countries, you see the German emphasis on BSI, you see the French emphasis on ANSI, the UK, I think it was TCR. And then countries that aren't quite as advanced as those, you know, they want to make sure that their exigencies are addressed, but they're more willing to follow the practices of others. And so I think that when the EU comes up with some things, I think there's going to be a tendency to go with those. And I think in the more developing countries where they have even greater resource constraints, it's harder for them to attract multiple suppliers. One of the things that's great when we're in a number of these countries, we can be one of multiple suppliers for the radio access network. And that provides not just greater competition, but it provides greater resilience. When you're in a country that doesn't have that level of resources, it's harder to have those multiple suppliers. But yes, there's definitely a tendency that they want to use standards so that when we're dealing, for example, in countries in Africa, they want to know what are the recognized standards recognized by other organizations, other countries that you're going to use when you put the products into our networks and cooperate with our carriers.
Well, you know, I want to ask a question about the use case in places like Africa. I know that there are many countries in Africa and Southeast Asia, especially, where we've seen the wireless carriers take on many aspects of the banking system, people using them for payments and things like that. Do those additional uses come into the conversation when they're discussing security and privacy issues with you?
Well, the use case and the business case, which is just gigantic around the world in terms of 5G generally, where you have the increased visibility, for example, of course, work from home, but 5G-enabled technologies to help with healthcare. I think the business case for the importance of that for healthcare, whether it's going to be, you know, wave two of the pandemic or the next level of pandemic, or the need to be able to bring in high-quality resources and big data and AI for the benefit of folks that may be remote, that are somewhere else. The use case, the business case, is critically important because it's not just government. Usually it's network or telecom operators who have to spend money and have to make the investment, and they don't want a big lag time between when they make the investment and when they're going to get the results. So that's kind of a balancing of kind of, you know, what is driving it, kind of a bottom up, what's driving it that can convince the telecom and mobile operators that it's worth it to spend the money and convince the governments to help support it, where they think it's going to really help their country be competitive in terms of technology and the kind of industries and businesses that might be enabled by 5G.
Outstanding. I appreciate that. I know it's a complex set of questions as you move between the various economies and various needs of countries around the world. Well, for my last question to you, I have something that comes from an entirely different direction. So we're going to move away from 5G entirely. In my role over at Dark Reading as a senior editor, I talk to a lot of CSOs and a lot of CISOs. And a bunch of them have a life as a former attorney. What is it about being a lawyer that creates this pipeline into the CSO role? Should people who want to be CSOs decide that they need a JD rather than a degree in computer science?
No, I don't know. If you have to choose, if I had it to do over again, I would get the degree in computer science if I could do it. And you got to wonder sometimes if part of the reason that people who are lawyers move into something like cybersecurity or privacy is because they can. Law is not for everyone, and a lengthy, even successful legal career is not necessarily something you want to do for the rest of your life. And you know, in the last 18 or 19 years where I've been working in cybersecurity, the growing recognition of the importance of this and the dynamic changing nature of this. And frankly, some of the aspects, as you know, in terms of information security and network security, the emphasis really is on risk management rather than compliance. However, when you're within an organization, you've got to make sure you've identified the requirements for the different elements and activities, such as IT and HR and procurement and whatever. And you've got to make sure that you're going to hold people accountable using separation of duties, using independent audits. Basically, it's compliant functions to make sure risk management is working. So while risk management is the mantra, compliance is very important, and lawyers have some experience with compliance, so that might be part of it.
So before we close up, I did have a couple more questions kind of related to people's roles. Now, with Huawei Technologies US, how is that being affected by some of the latest visa restrictions that are going on from the US?
Well, right now, we have fairly small operations in the United States. I mean, frankly, the amount of revenue that we've had in the years I've been here is not really very significant. And we're much more concerned about our ability to do business in the United States because, you know, we've got a number of rural operators who depend on our products, who depend on our services, who can't get it otherwise. And we have a history in rural countries, and we want to, you know, we want to help maintain that. So the visa restrictions at present have really not had any impact. I'm not aware of there being any impact. I have to think over time that there will be some impact, but we're not really sure what that will be. I mean, the U.S. government is basically doing a system of stepped escalations over the last at least 18 months to try to continue to hurt China by hurting Huawei. And so now they've turned to visa restrictions, and they'll probably come up with something else next.
Right. Well, Andy, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little low on time. I did want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can learn more about Huawei, your organization, and some of the latest offerings.
Well, folks can reach out to me on my Twitter site. I'd be happy to send some references. Our Huawei.com site, the English language site with solutions, where we go into the kinds of solutions we're working on, and generally it's in partnership with others, solutions in the artificial intelligence and cloud space, what we're doing using these kinds of enhanced analytics to help increase the cybersecurity assurance of our products and the extent to which our products can be trusted by others. So I encourage you to come to the Huawei.com site or write to me, and I'll be happy to try to direct you if you have particular interests.
Thanks again. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your device to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
Packing and more packing. But you know what? I've actually touched Huawei equipment. I'm actually setting up a wireless internet service provider, and Huawei actually has a lot of gear in the GPON world. So ought to be interesting in the long term.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chibert. Well, we also think of Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's coming up for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
Well, by the time you get to midweek, I'm going to be kind of all black hat all the time. So this coming week, you can find my writing, as always, at Dark Reading and the Edge of Dark Reading. I'll be doing lots of tweeting and even try to see if I can get more stuff up on Instagram. So follow both my accounts. That's KG4GWA on Twitter and Kurt_Franklin on Instagram. But always head over to Dark Reading because that's where you'll see my latest writing, and that's where we're going to be covering these two conferences and getting ready for a very active virtual safe mode conference season for the fall.
I'm really looking forward to it. Well, thanks again for being here, guys. We want to thank you as well as you're the people at home. You're the person who drops in each and every week. You listen to our show and get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and to listen to catch up on enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing episodes, our back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and those links that we do during the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, Next to those videos, you get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio or your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely check it out. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So definitely subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, and your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because you know what? They need to stay on top of their enterprise and IT news as well. So definitely share with them. Now, after you've subscribed and you might be available during the day around Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. We do the show live, live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run. Come see how the pizza is made. Come see all the banter, all the fun stuff that we talk about. That's live.twit.tv. And if you're going to jump in and watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well. We have a great set of characters. Some great questions came out of there today. So definitely check out the chat room as well, irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room, and we would love you to be part of it as well. Now, if you can't watch the show live, you can't be part of the live show, the live stream, as well as the live chat room, come join the 24/7 discussion over at our twit.community. It's a really great website where all of our co-hosts and hosts are out there. We talk about technology, all the topics, all the shows. We talk about their 24/7 discussion at twit.community. Now, remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, I get to have great conversations with people like you. You can see how I'm building my deck in the backyard. You can see how I'm talking a lot about the upcoming Black Hat and DEF CON and all of the latest and greatest enterprise things that are coming up. Plus, you can see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft at developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really couldn't do this show without them. So thank you for their all support. And of course, I want to thank all the engineers and all the staff at Twit. And of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do this show without him. So thank you again, Cheebert, for all your support. And before we sign out, we have to thank Victor. He's our editor, as well as our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much for all your support and keeping us on our toes, because we're constantly changing stuff on you. We appreciate all your support and all your help.
That's okay. That's what keeps me on my toes. I look and see a change, and I'm like, oh, no, I got to get it in there before they cut to it. Great job. Hey, great show. A lot of information there. Could have been longer, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They always could be longer, right? But yeah, that's what the other episodes are for. So
that's
keep
right.
Tuned.
That's right. Thank you, sir.
Before we sign out, we just want to remember you. If you want to keep it, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, host at Twit TV. Got a question for you. Have you gotten tired of how bad your photos are looking every time you post them to Instagram? Better yet, have you gotten yourself a new camera and you can't quite figure out why the images just don't look that good? Well, I have a solution for you. It's my show, Hands On Photography. Each and every Thursday, I sit down and share different tips and tricks that are going to help make you a better photographer and a better post processor. So subscribe today at twit.tv/hop to learn more.